KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Sometimes we have to fight for our right to be cold. That's according to Sheila Watt Cloutier. She's an Inuit activist who tackles issues Indigenous people are facing, including pollution and sustainability. Watt Cloutier spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on March 11th as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series.
Is this going to come down? It's not going to stay down? Can you hear me? Yes, it's good? Okay, so I always start in my own language, and as I said, I think there might be just one person in the audience tonight that would understand, and the great McMallon, who is a remarkable human being who has lived in Nunavut for many, many, many years and is very proficient in my language, although he doesn't like to admit that. But he's a teacher, and he's doing some teaching here with some of the students here from the University of Washington. So Mick is going to be my grounding force here tonight, as he knows my world very well, very, very well. In fact, Mick's house was five houses away from mine in Tundra Valley in Iqaluit for many, many years. So it's wonderful to be here. Thank you very much. I've had a very rich couple of days here already, where I have felt very, very nourished at so many levels. So I'm just really thrilled to be here. I thank everyone for welcoming me here. But before I start, I always like to acknowledge and recognize the traditional lands of where I speak, and it is with the Duwamish people and also the Puyallup tribe upon which I speak, so I honor that. I'm Inuk, which is singular for Inuit, and come from Coudjouac, Quebec, a small community. Traveled only by dog team the first 10 years of my life, and started to speak English only when I was 6 years of age. And so that's my tradition from where I come from, coming from being raised by two single Inuit women, and that has been the humble beginnings of my life. Now, the world has certainly, and again, my connection to Nadine as well has been strengthened here. I met her before in Canada, in Ottawa, during the ITK. So I thank you very much for welcoming me with you and Vince in the beginning of all of this, but to everyone who has been just so kind to me, and I thank you for that. And thank you, of course, to whoever has allowed me to come all the way here in that sense, and that's all the university departments and the donors, of course. So thank you very, very much. I always have these pictures behind me as I speak because I like to bring the Arctic to you. And so as we know, the world has become increasingly aware of the Arctic, and of course the Arctic now remains at the forefront of the public consciousness as both an area of great environmental concern, but also as a place with great economic and geopolitical interest and even tension, for those of you who know a little bit about what's happening in the Arctic. But there is room for, of course, and hopefully for a renewed political cooperation. And all of this has certainly confirmed that the Arctic is an area of utmost importance in the minds of many global policymakers, of many researchers, and, of course, the economic interests that are now coming because as a result of the melting ice. And so what I've tried to do when I speak around not so much around the world anymore, because since I left ICC in 2006, I've remained an independent who speaks at various venues when I am invited to do so in Canada and the United States. So I've tried to limit my travels now to not too far away, as I practically lived on an airplane for 11 years doing this work internationally. And a little burnt out at the end of those 11 years, so I've tried to gauge my energy as I continue to travel to closer places to lend this message. And so I try very hard to allow people to understand the interconnectedness that we all have, and I have done so in the classes in the last 2 days as well as I spoke to students and faculty. and that everything is related, and the message of connectivity is one that's really important for us. And it's really important to consider that the Arctic is the place that often, and you wouldn't understand this when you don't really see all those connections, but the Arctic really can connect us. You know, it is the cooling system, after all, for the planet. And as the warming is happening, it really is affecting many other places around the world as the ice melts in the Arctic. And so we in the Arctic are really facing incredibly new interests that are coming north, and we're having to be rather cautious about what is going to happen next, as we're just coming out the other side of the first wave of tumultuous change that we have lived through so much in the Arctic. And so as we reach out to connect with the rest of the world to ask that they change their behaviors so that we don't suffer those kinds of consequences in the north, we also have to be thinking in the Arctic about recognizing the many interconnections that exist today and will soon exist around the world by the use of our Arctic regions. That includes, of course, the oceans and the lands. Now, the Arctic, for many of the students who seem to have learned a lot of this already in your schools and your classes, the Arctic has been subjected to the most dramatic environmental effects of globalization, from the persistent organic pollutants, as was mentioned earlier, where the toxins made their way up into our food chain and the nursing milk of our mothers, to the point where our mothers had to think twice about nursing their babies when this raw data came into our awareness in the mid-1980s. And that was really an alarming time for us. And, of course, the weakened ozone layer is much more visible, and we feel the effects of that in the Arctic through the UV radiations, which often causes and has been causing, not just in, I don't talk just in terms of the Canadian Arctic, but certainly the circumpolar Arctic, where there have been a lot of epidemics of cataracts as a result of that. And there's a lot more skin problems that are occurring as a result of the high levels of UV radiations. So it becomes once again an issue of health for the people. And of course, most recently, the huge changes that have happened to our land and to our ice from climatic changes. And so we've really borne the brunt of development from our home, and we've been really compelled through our various organizations to reach out to the world so that we can tell those kinds of stories and allow citizens of the world to understand better what is happening in the Arctic as it relates to everybody else. And so we are, as I always say, are what the astronauts say, in fact, the ground truthers. We're the ground truthers of the observations that often are confirmed by observation, confirm the observations that are made by, through satellites and climate models. And with that kind of very intimate and holistic understanding of our land, we've known for a long time now that there's a great deal of certainty that there's many changes happening to our climate. And as Inuit, we place a great deal of value to the ice and snow. It is, after all, the very stable platform that has allowed us to hunt and to train our children for life, for untold millennia. And there's no price that you could pay many of us to lose that ice. And I think the whole world will soon learn to place a great value on that as well, and on the cold, because we're learning more and more just how expensive it is to be losing what we call the air conditioner, the cooling system for the planet, because that is starting to break down. And as a result, you start to see all that is happening in southern parts of the world. And as I said, you know, as northern indigenous peoples, we are those ground truthers for global environmental change. And for decades, we have seen and experienced the rapid change firsthand, whether they were the toxins ending up in our food chain and poisoning us, or the rapid changes that certainly have touched every fiber of our beings and our communities and our lives as Indigenous peoples in the North. And these issues for us are not just environmental, but they are first and foremost health. And they are about health of families, of individuals, of our communities, and the health of our environment, and certainly the health of our wildlife in the Arctic. And we are highly, you know, an independent people, and we certainly were, having our own systems in place, our own education systems, our own justice and health and social systems, which were very much based on Inuit wisdom. And we prepared our young people for these challenges and the opportunities of life in a very holistic way. And I spoke to students about that today. And then these changes happened very quickly. I mean, even in my lifetime, you know, coming from a very traditional way of life in one lifetime, we've come from that clearly a very community-oriented traditional way of life. And in one lifetime, where most societies have taken perhaps 350 years to adjust and to adapt from a hunter-gatherer society, for us it has been almost in one lifetime. And so the speed in which things have happened have certainly contributed to the problems and the challenges that we face. And a lot of these challenges that we face in terms of dependencies, you know, whether it's to substances or institutions or processes that we're facing now, along with the historical traumas, which many people have not heard about. And I taught university at Bowdoin College as a visiting scholar a couple of years ago, and then at Mount Allison in New Brunswick. And many people, whether it's American students at universities or Canadian students in Canadian universities, have not heard a lot about that. And so the context, I try to put into context what you often see and hear in the media about the social problems and health problems that we are faced in our communities. So these historical traumas, which, you know, I will talk about a little bit, but these historical traumas have certainly helped to erode our sense of identity and our sense of self-worth, and they certainly help to lessen our ability to think and act for ourselves. And this, of course, in turn, has translated into the monumental health and social problems that is faced by Northern Indigenous peoples, which all too often is misunderstood as our inability to adapt to the modern world, which is really not the truth. We are a very adaptable people. In fact, that's one of our strongest traits, is to be adaptable to new situations on any given day due to the environment that we live in. And so we should realize that these kinds of problems that we face in terms of substance abuse, the health problems, and of course, one of the most distressing situations for us in our Inuit world is the high suicide rates, which are known to be the highest in North America. And so these are not our natural state for our people. And through all of the tumultuous changes that we have been going through over the years, we've always had our land. We've had the predictability of the climate, and we've had the wisdom of many of our elders to see us through and to help us to adapt. But today things are very different. Things are very unpredictable. And so the dramatic climate change caused by greenhouse gas emissions and gases have left virtually no feature of our landscape or our way of life untouched, and now threatens certainly on many fronts our way of life, our culture, and our ability to live off the land and eat our country food, which means eating the animals that we hunt. And oftentimes if you're living in one area, for example, in Nunavut, there are areas that are not as negatively impacted. But I always come in with that bird's eye view of the work that I've done circumpolarly, just to see and to signal that there is trends that are much more dire. There's climatic changes happening that are much more dire in certain areas, and one of them is Alaska, USA, and the western part of the Inuvialuit region, the Beaufort Sea area, as a result of the coast there. And so you have to remember also that nowhere else in the world does snow and ice represent transportation and mobility as it does for us Inuit. When the land is full of snow and the ice is formed, that becomes our highways to go out hunting and to connect with one another out on the land as we hunt and fish. And when that becomes precarious, it becomes an issue of safety and security first and foremost. So that has been one of the biggest issues for us now, of course, is the safety. And in all four regions in Canada where we live, which is the Labrador, Nunavik, Nunavut, and the Inuvialuit region, and in fact, all, in all the four countries where we live, we're struggling to cope with coastal erosion. And again, as I say, in other parts, it's really quite dire. As we know in Alaska, there are communities there, and I've spoken again to people here at this university, where there's actual relocations that are needing to happen as a result of even the homes now falling into the sea. So these are very real. The melting permafrost, for many people, would know that in my own region of Nunavik, in Sutluit, there have been homes that were buckling as a result of permafrost melting, and now they're relocating to another part of the town. And now they're worried about the town planning, wondering, okay, if all the houses start to buckle, where do we move? And who will cover those costs? So this is starting to happen because in Nunavik, where I come from, it's just below the tree line, so it's even warmer than Nunavut, where I was living and where Mick and Alexina, his wife, live. And so there are certain areas that are being hit much harder than other areas. And there's and of course, a rapid runoff, as we know. Mick would remember that a few years ago, there was such a rapid runoff in Bannitoq that it cut the town in two because the runoff happened so quickly that it went right straight down and divided the town in two right down to the bedrock, and the bridge was washed out. And, you know, these kinds of sudden things that we had not ever anticipated or expected in that way in the Arctic are starting to happen. And glaciers, of course, long relied on for drinking water, are now unpredictable. And hunters say, well, I'm going to go and get my glacier water, my glacier ice for my tea while I'm out hunting, because they were there the year before, and only to go, and in 1 year, that's gone. You know, so there's certain icebergs and smaller glaciers that are melting very rapidly. And, of course, we know about the Greenland story. You know, Greenland is an ice cap itself completely, and so that's starting. And we know that work, I'm sure you've heard of James, you know, Billon, who did that remarkable Chasing Ice documentary. And of course, you know that while his students were there with their cameras, the size of Manhattan broke right off of Greenland while they were there. So these things are happening. And so while the size and the type of these changes vary, the trends are very consistent in the circumpolar world.
Sheila Watt-Cloutier, a Canadian Inuit activist. She spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on March 11th as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to KUOW.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Sheila Watt-Cloutier in a moment. 24 minutes past 9 now, KUOW 94.9. Later tonight, we're going to hear the UN Refugee Agency's representative for Lebanon talk about the number of refugees from the Syrian civil war now in Lebanon reaching 1 million today and what that means for the country. Also, an Inuit musician taking part in a counter-demonstration against Ellen DeGeneres' protest of seal hunting talks about the threats she's getting in return. Both those items tonight at 11 on As It Happens. Forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows in the 40s, breezy, rain at times this evening, mostly cloudy with scattered showers after midnight. For Friday, highs lower to mid-50s, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers in the morning, showers likely in the afternoon. Support for KUOW comes from the breast clinics at Virginia Mason Medical Centers in Seattle and Federal Way, providing access to care and treatment for any breast concern. More at virginiamason.org/breastclinic.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Sometimes we have to fight for our right to be cold. That's according to Sheila Watt-Cloutier. She's an Inuit activist who tackles issues Indigenous people are facing, including pollution and sustainability. Watt-Cloutier spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on March 11th as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series.
So in light of that, in light of what was happening to our world, and at the time I was chair of Inuit Circumpolar Council, and I was just coming out the other side of negotiating, helped to negotiate the UN treaty on getting the world to understand that the issue of POPs, the toxins in our bodies and the nursing milk of our mothers, was one an urgent matter of health that needed to be addressed. We were able to be successful in doing that, but at the same time, we also knew that the climate change that was looming was going to be a tougher call for us in dealing with these issues. And we had dealt with many challenges in the work of the Arctic Council with the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, which was one of the greatest assessments made early on before even the International Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, had come out with their strong science. And so we used that as to fill that void in science that POPs had over the, you know, we had developed over the years, and translated that data and into international policy. But in climate change, we didn't have that strong science as yet until we worked on and produced the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, where many great Americans were involved in that research, and Bob Correll was the chair of that assessment, and the secretariat was in Fairbanks, Alaska. But to cut through all of that, and not to bore you with the science and the politics of that, which you will read eventually next year in my book, the details of that challenge. But we had to do something more than just put the human face on the map, which we had successfully done with the toxins issue. We knew that there would be a lot more we needed to do, and so we started to strategize and think about what is it we need to do to really make this much more of a human dimension issue, because after all, our right to maintain our culture, a hunting culture on the ice and snow, was so critical and so crucial for us to fight for. And so we started to think about some of these things, and after 2 years of preparation, we had already strategized and decided that we would go in the direction of a legal petition. Not just a signing of names, but it's a legal action, a legal document of 167 pages, which you can look up on earthjustice.org, and my testimony to the Commission on Inter-American Commission on Human Rights that we were able to present a part of. Not, they wouldn't view our full petition in the end, but at the same time, we helped to change the discourse on this issue globally. And so in light of that threat that I talk about that poses our traditional way of life, in 2005, 62 hunters and elders and myself, we brought forth a petition. And what we said was that we used the Inter-American or the 1948 American Declaration on the Rights and Duties of Man. So that instrument already existed, and we used that to bring forth that petition. And it was, people say, well, what human rights were violated, you know, in that sense. Again, don't forget, our way of life is the very foundation of Inuit culture is the ice, the snow, and the cold. And as that goes, it diminishes our ability to be the hunters that we are and to have our culture intact as we would wish for it to be for a long time yet to come. And so the purpose of this petition that we launched was to educate and encourage the government of the United States to join the community of nations, because in those years, during that administration, it was very difficult. U.S. at the time was always the odd man out in the global negotiations in trying to deal with the emissions issue. And so we led that campaign in that way. And it was not an aggressive or confrontational act. I led that campaign. And from that place, it was one of calm, but it was very assertive. And it was clear that we were defending a way of life. And so we were reaching out, not striking out. And in fact, it was a gift. It was an act of generosity from our hunters. From our hunters that are still and remain very connected to the natural environment and in tune to the cycles of nature, to a very urban setting, which we felt was largely lost its place in that position of the natural world. And so that was our strategy. And I've always said that it was the most caring act, in fact, that I have ever brought forward in the protection of the future of my grandson. Now I have two, but in those days I had the one. And for the grandsons of many, for the next generation, knowing that the foundation upon which I was born is why I'm able to do what I do, because of that beginnings that I had in terms of respecting our environment, our culture, and each other. And so it wasn't personal, the petition targeting the United States, because it was about trying to get America on side with the issues that were so important, not just to the Arctic, but to the planet. But it certainly was personal when our nursing mothers had to think twice about nursing their babies in the 80s, when all of this information was coming out that we were indeed being poisoned from afar. And certainly personal when my grandson and the grandsons of many may lose that culture and that wisdom that gets passed down to our children. And so we acted with a great deal of focus and strategy from a real position of strength and not victimhood to signal to the world the urgency of the matter. So we were reaching out and trying to make this move from public opinion to public policy. That was our strategy. And although in the end the commission chose not to move forward with the petition itself, they did ask me to come down and speak at the first historical hearing on the links between climate change and human rights. And I believe at that time we did change a lot of the focus from a story of greenhouse gas emissions, carbon, CO2s, to one of the human dimension by focusing on human rights. And so this message has led to a lot of change around the world, with the rest of the world, and the UN Human Rights Council now recognizes climate change as a human rights for all indigenous people, and Oxfam as well has joined the chorus, arguing for that kind of paradigm shift in our thinking on climate change. And indeed, echoing exactly our words in the petition, they now argue that the only language of fundamental rights rather than economics will produce a climate change solution. And again, I go back to the community and the issues that we face in terms of the health impacts of the changes that we're facing in our communities. And we rely heavily, of course, still on our traditional food, our subsistence food. Already, though climate change has affected the migration and the quality of our animals, making it harder for them to hunt and less safe as well. And we hear stories over and over again. And the testimonies that I gathered for the petition, in fact, we videotaped all of these elders and hunters in Canada and Alaska, the 62 that signed on with me, and they are on isuma.tv, which is one of the our own success stories of Zach Kunuk in Igloolik, who has made, you know, The Fast Runner, if any of you has ever seen that movie. And it's on his website, all of these testimonies that I talk about. And so they're there for anybody who ever wants to do that. And already, as I say, you know, the animals are being impacted by that. And our hunters are having to, and it also affects our economy, because our hunters are now having to reroute themselves in longer ways to get to the same place that they have been hunting in for generations. And of course, it costs more money to reroute yourself in longer ways with, you know, supplies of fuel and food and so on. And so the hunting often is now, the season is shortened. Not all the time in all the regions, as I say, but certainly the trends are there. And the unsafe conditions together with the unpredictable weather means that there are more accidents. There is more losses amongst our hunters in the last decade or so. And many are often now have second thoughts if there's even a chance that there's going to be some unpredictable weather coming about. And there are more and more of our hunters that are having to be rescued due to breaking ice around the flow edge. And so with less traditional food that oftentimes during certain seasons, of course, more families then become more stressed to buy the high cost of imported southern foods. And of course, this leads away from the very highly nutritious country food and to more southern diets. And of course, this is less healthy because the cheaper foods are the processed foods in the Arctic, and they're very high. And certainly Mick and I can attest to the fact that it's two or three times higher when you're buying groceries at Northmart. It's very expensive. And so our communities, in fact, when you move away from traditional food, have shown that there's increasingly high rates of diabetes now and other food-related illnesses, certainly in Canada. And from having lunch with my fellow Indigenous women today, that trend is everywhere, you know, in all of our Aboriginal communities. And so as we shift away from that, of course, then there's this reliance on expensive southern imports, which only deepens that reliance on government support in our communities, which is the very opposite of building thriving local economies, which, you know, that incorporate heavily the elements of our traditional culture, which is what we're trying to do, is find our ground once again, you know, from all of the rapid change that has been happening. And that's really important for us, and that's why we fight so hard to defend our environment, because it isn't just about environment.
Sheila Watt Cloutier, a Canadian Inuit activist. She spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on March 11th as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Sheila Watt Cloutier in a moment, 937, 94.9 KUOW. Later tonight, we'll hear Canada's former Auditor General, who's now co-chair of Elections Canada's advisory panel, tell why she's characterizing the proposed Fair Elections Act as an attack on democracy. Also, a woman who was 1 month into a six-month internship at Chatelaine talks about losing said internship as the magazine reacted to an Ontario Labour Ministry crackdown on unpaid internships. Both items on As It Happens tonight at 11. Forecast says lows in the 40s tonight, breezy, rain at times this evening, mostly cloudy with scattered showers after midnight. Friday highs lower to mid-50s. Mostly cloudy with a chance of showers in the morning, showers likely in the afternoon. Iconic songwriter Jimmy Webb talks about his work and presents some of his most memorable songs, including Galveston and MacArthur Park, beginning in a few minutes at 10 o'clock on Song Travels with Michael Feinstein. If you've been waiting to as late into the pledge drive as you possibly can to make that pledge, oh, Speakers Forum fan, then maybe right now is a good time to go for it, because we're very close to the end. Make that pledge in any amount you see fit to kuow.org. The website's set up to make it quick and easy. What more do you want? Pledge now at kuow.org, and thanks. Support for KUOW comes from Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, a way to print a different image on every card in the pack. Learn more at Moo.com.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Sometimes we have to fight for our right to be cold. That's according to Sheila Watt Cloutier. She's an Inuit activist who tackles issues Indigenous people are facing, including pollution and sustainability. Watt Cloutier spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on March 11th as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series.
And also, we've realized, too, that our children, many of the younger generation, have a better chance of choosing healthier lives, and the human faces are coming up now. If we remain true to the principles and the values of our wisdom and the wisdom of our hunting culture, our children do have a better chance in the choices that they make, not just in terms of food, but in terms of choices that they make in life, so that they're embracing life rather than taking it. And we are as I mentioned earlier, very uniquely adaptable. We have weathered that storm of modernization remarkably well. Again, as I say, you know, coming from dog team to flying jumbo jets jets to Seattle, you know, in one lifetime, it's happened very quickly. We've come from what you call igloos, for us it's illuvigas, to modern housing. and permanent homes just in, you know, my mother's lifetime. And so these changes and these enormous changes have not been without consequences. Enormous consequences. Much of the loss of the control over our lives added with, as I say, the historical traumas in a very short period of time, along with, and these historical traumas which a lot of people don't know about, even in Canada when I was teaching at Mount Allison, the university kids didn't know that history, and it really shocked them. You know, there were forced relocations in the 1950s from Nunavik communities that were forced up to Grease Fjord and Resolute Bay in the name of sovereignty. And that was very traumatic for those families. This is my favorite picture because it shows you the joy of being out in the Arctic. And it's our right to be cold, which is what we're defending. And this is what this personifies for me. I just love that picture. And, you know, you get this image of out there shivering in almost like a victim to the environment, but we're not. We're really fighting for our right to be cold because we love what it is to be out in as Inuit. And everything, you know, the ecosystem, the people, the wildlife, everything is thriving as from the cold. And we have so many resources around us that just keep strengthening us on a daily basis and connect us and bond us to each other and to each and to our communities. So these forced relocations were a big part of the traumas. Children uprooted from their families and culture to be deprogrammed and reprogrammed. I was one of them. I was 10 years old when I was sent away for school, and I lost my language, and I had to gain it back. We had this history of dog slaughters that were happening in Nunavik and Nunavut, and there's just more and more of those stories coming out as we speak. You know, again, it's a contentious issue because the folks who were there in the early years say, no, it didn't happen. The hunters testify it certainly did, and were left without their dogs when their families were out in the outpost camps. So those histories are there. The inquiries have been done. Documentaries have been made of that. So it's a real situation that happened in our world, even if others refuse to believe that it's true. Sexual abuse from those in authority have just negatively impacted generations of families. The collapse of the sealskin market. You know, when Brigitte Bardot single-handedly came over here in the 60s and demolished the sealing in Canada, the commercial sealing, well, it was that broad stroke that also affected very negatively our hunters in the communities. And so our hunters, who were coming through a transitioning period at the time, were hunting seals for their families, but the byproduct of the hunt to feed their families was being sold, and many families were doing quite well with that. Men were making $18,000 a year in those days, which was a lot for a family, and with the broad stroke of the well-intended, misguided emotional stances that many had in those years to demolish the seal hunt, and that broad stroke, Inuit communities were negatively impacted, really was the start of the wounded spirit of the hunter. And that was one of them, and along with all of the others that I mentioned. And of course now we're dealing with the monumental changes that are happening with our environment. So the first wave came and knocked us off our feet. You know, and as we start to recognize and turn that corner of what has happened to us in our world, here we are, a strong people, resilient, brilliant, and the ingenuity of being able to build a home of snow warm enough for your babies to sleep in naked. That's pretty ingenious, don't you think? And also, you know, the inventors of the Haya, which is the most renowned boat in the world that people have replicated. So you see, we're not powerless victims. We are there. There's a brilliance in our culture. And I don't say this from ego. I just say this because so many times our culture we have been depicted as powerless over globalization with the inability to adapt, which, is very far from the truth. But all of those things that have been happening as we come out the other side of the first wave, the very thing that we're now reaching to for some of the solutions for the suicides and all the problems that we face, which is our culture and the foundation, that underpins that culture, which is based on values and principles and strength and wisdom, is starting to melt before our very eyes. And so you see, this is not an issue of just ice melting. This is not just an issue of the polar bear. It is an issue of Inuit communities that are trying to make it so that their children can choose to embrace life and thrive and be part of society that everyone else has that ability, that everyone else in an equal footing and platform can choose the options that are good for them and that are life-affirming rather than life-taking. This is what this work is about. It's about connecting us as families, as mothers, as grandmothers, and grandfathers and fathers, as we move to try to understand that what's happening in the Arctic is really important to all of us, whether it's the Arctic or people of Seattle, people of the United States, because we're in it together as a common shared humanity. And it's unfortunate that it's our very troubled atmosphere that seems to be now bringing us together in that way, but so be it. If that's what it takes, then let's start to look at these things. But all of this collective pain that is happening, again, we've had our way of life to ground us, but things are so very different today. And so the issue now, the questionable predictability that is being caused by, or the unpredictability by climatic change, is also showing up, as I say, in the loss of food security, which to us is yet another systemic challenge from the South that we're facing in the Arctic about our food. And we cannot separate that from any of all the other challenges that we have been facing throughout. And one of the things that most people have not come to understand, and I said I would get to this, and I've been speaking about this a little bit in the classes, is that the hunt itself is not well understood. You know, people conjure up this image of the hunter going out with a rifle is somehow equates it to someone who's not a very calm or reflective or wise person. But the hunter in our culture is revered. The elder is revered. And a good seasoned hunter, elder, personifies a remarkable human being. This is my grandson, Winhu, and that's why I do what I do. This was when he was quite young. He's 16 and a half today, and he was on a boat with his father hunting in Iqaluit. But the hunter spirit is one that is very calm and reflective, and with a great deal of judgment and a great deal of wisdom to know not only the lay of the land, but how to transfer wisdom and skills to the next generation. And the process of the hunt, which teaches our young people what I call the character building or the life skills, is really key. It is not just the technique of hunting that is taught. In fact, when you go out into the land, and you're waiting for the snow to fall or the ice to form, the weather to improve, and the winds to die down, you're automatically being taught patience. And you're taught also, in the conditions that you're in, to be bold under pressure, to withstand stress, how not to be impulsive. One of the things that we're finding in our quest to lower the suicide rates is that suicide is a very impulsive act. And it's not to take away the pain that we go through when we are struggling in these dark places. And this is universal, of course. But it is about making those choices in a different way. If you have learned that impulsivity on the land and the ice doesn't pay off, in fact, it puts you and your family at risk if you act impulsively. If you have been able to learn that and it's integrated within you, then you can use that. It's transferable into the modern world where you can remember the times where impulsivity didn't do you any good. Then in times of great stressors in the modern world, where our young people tend to take their lives so very quickly, It can help you in those times of darkness. And so there are those kinds of skills that nature and a hunting culture teaches you. And ultimately, what it is also teaching you is sound judgment and wisdom. And Silatunik is the core of our culture. And that's what we hope that our children would gain as they learn the survival skills, which can be transferred to the modern world. And in fact, the kids who have learned that, whether through hunting or through other activities that allowed them to find out and learn and develop who they are, because the hunting technical skills that one learns is about how the world works. But the character building and the character skills of courage and persistence and the resistance to impulsivity, all of those are about how you work. And so that's really important pieces as we universally teach our children and as students to learn more about yourself and how you work, which is really important because at the end of the day, it's not going to be the technical skills necessarily. They will help. Or your academic skills necessarily, but they will help. But it is about the skills that you learned about how you tick and how you react to stressful situations that are going to be there for you in the end as you overcome obstacles and challenges in your life. And so those are the things that we're trying to deal with now and learn about how even the new unexpected, unpredictable stressors that are going to come about now with not only climatic changes that are going to increase, but the rapid influx of development that's going to add certainly to the situation that we're already grappling with. So when we're discussing problems faced by our families, it's often very necessary to see how these many changes interconnect to cause the problems across so many dimensions of our community's well-being. So, again, so my work on persistent organic pollutants and connecting human rights to climate change has really focused on trying to see these issues very holistically and ensuring that the human faces of this issue are in the minds of policymakers when discussing how to address them. And we know that, including my own country and here, we've just not been able to have even the greatest of science and the human stories affect the policies at the national or international level as yet. And so there's a lot more that needs to be done. And I think it only deepens the need, certainly, for all the parties to adopt that human, that rights-based human approach to this solution. And I think the lesson here for all of us who care about our planet and our children in the future is that while that language of economics and technology is always going to ask for further delay or for real certainty, you know. Are you sure the science is correct? Are you sure it's not going to affect our economy? All of those things. Okay, they're valid questions, but there comes a point where, you know, we have to trust and know from the scientists themselves, as well as, of course, the people on the ground who are living the realities, who in their own right are scientists, which are our elders and hunters in all of our northern communities, in all of our Aboriginal communities, who are faced with that everyday, immediate situation where the judgment has to be taken on, is it safe today to get out there on the ice and snow? And what else is going to happen with all of these things that are happening, with the new species coming up, and what kind of diseases is that going to bring, and so on. So I think these kinds of delays are tactics that we can't buy into forever, because reframing the debate, I think, in fundamental human rights and the connections between environmental change and cultural rights refocuses the issue on the debate on humanity, our common humanity, and not just economy. And so the world has not fully yet heard us completely, but it's I think it's time, and I think as a common, again, as I say, humanity, we have to start to think in those terms. Am I over my limit? How much time do I have? Another couple of minutes? Yeah, I'm fine? Okay, good. I like to try to respect the time that I've been given, and I don't want to put anybody here to sleep either. So the human faces are really important, I think, to be part of that dialogue. In fact, they're a requirement for the world to recognize each other. Because I think that's where the problems lie, is that we don't see each other. We don't recognize each other. You know, people tend to think the people of the Arctic, well, what do I have in common with them? And what is this all about? And I can't relate to the cold or the ice and snow. And often we're asked, who would want to live there? Is it always cold? Is it always dark? You know, do you all live in igloos? All of these things. But in reality, you know, we all want the same. We all want our children to be happy, to be safe, to be educated effectively, and to choose, you know, life-affirming choices for themselves so that they can be the citizens that they are meant to be in the world, knowing where they stand in life. And we are all in this together. And so northern cultures, you know, just cannot be simply window dressing. And because for the interests of too many that are in control of all of these development decisions, oftentimes they're the ones in control. And so we need to continuously be respected in that way. And inform the decisions and the positions, you know, that we can think about these issues in a much broader sense, in terms of a broad-based principled rethinking of the strategies as we go into some of these national or international negotiations. And I think by setting the kind of examples at home too for ourselves, as you know, we're desperate for jobs in the North. So people are wanting to head in the same direction as what our bigger, larger government seem to have a real plan in place. And it's very evident now in the Arctic that even in our own country, you know, the Arctic is now going to be used as the ability for our government and our nation to become the super energy power for the world because of the melt and because of the oil and gas and the minerals and all of that lie, that are going to be much more accessible for these businesses that are coming in. So I think we have to reframe, and again, as I say, the human rights approach for me really is the way to go, because these issues, you know, if you just see them in the language or understand them in the language of economics and technology, this approach silos all of these issues that I talk about. It separates them, in other words. And as opposed to recognizing the connections between rights, human rights, between environment, health, economies, and society. And I think ultimately addressing climate change in the language of human rights and building those kind of human rights agreements and protections into the global agreements are more than just strategic choices. They're certainly ethical imperatives that demand the world retake that principled path and really courageously reconnect to solve this big problem that we're faced with in terms of climate change.
Sheila Watt Cloutier, a Canadian Inuit activist. She spoke at the University of Washington's Kane Hall on March 11th as part of the Graduate School Lecture Series. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Cornish College of the Arts, presenting Expo 14, including the staged musical production of the children's classic book, The Secret Garden, at the Cornish Playhouse, April 9th through the 12th. Information at cornish.edu/events. Just a few seconds before 10, KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady, urging you to delay no longer that pledge you've been thinking about making for the spring pledge drive. The website's big and wide open for you right now. Please make that pledge in any amount you see fit. Whatever is comfortable for you. Don't do anything uncomfortable, but do step forward to make that pledge. Let's end the spring pledge drive right, and thank you so much for your contribution.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.